is CoDiscovery. Hello, welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. What was behind the Neolithic demographic transition, a period which saw a dramatic increase in the birth rate? Did people take to the seas far earlier than previously thought? And if so, what inspired them to get into their boats and brave the waters? What is the difference between a flourishing desert frontier fort and one that dwindles into dust? Food. A change in the source of food, a supply of nutritious prey within reach if you can get to it, innovations in agriculture, and sophisticated means of irrigation that turn desert into pasture, all have had far-reaching impacts. Welcome to our three guests, who, with the help of support from the EU, can tell us how food was a driver for social change for three very different communities in antiquity. We shall be using the terms before the Common Era, BCE, and Common Era, CE, which correlate directly with BC and AD. Bettina Schulz-Poulsen, an associate professor of archaeology at the University of Gothenburg, Sweden, specializes in research related to the Stone Ages. Her interests encompass Stone Age seafaring, megaliths, prehistoric whaling, and scientific dating and methods. Hello, Bettina.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Welcome to Corinna Rossi, who is an associate professor of Egyptology at the Polytechnic of Milan. Her research focuses on the relationship between architecture and mathematics in ancient Egypt. Corinna has a special interest in the antiquities of Egypt's western desert, with special attention to the strategies of occupation and exploitation in the Roman era period. Welcome, Corinna.
Hello, hello, Abigail, and hello, everyone.
Sofia Stefanovic is Professor of Physical Anthropology and Bioarchaeology in the Department of Archaeology at the University of Belgrade in Serbia. She is interested in the prehistoric patterns of fertility and the influence of the duration of breastfeeding on children's health in the Neolithic period. Hello, Sofia.
Hello, Abigail, and thanks for having me.
Very welcome. We're delighted you're here. I'm going to turn to Bettina first. The Bronze Age has been associated with the start of maritime activity, but new data points to a much earlier date. The NeoSea project considered the data that points to the Neolithic seafaring and its role in shaping a new interconnected world of megalithic societies. Bettina, when do you believe that maritime activity and shipbuilding actually began then?
Maritime activity started actually as early as the Pleistocene, with the colonization of Australia as the most prominent example. And this is around, we're talking around 60,000 years ago. And in Europe, and there in particular along the Atlantic facet, along the Atlantic coast, I would say between Scandinavia and Portugal, seafaring and maritime, also long trade, was traditionally believed to have begun during the Bronze Age, around 2500, 2000 BCE. And we have now current evidence that suggests that it started at least 2000 years earlier, and this during the megalithic times. And this society must have possessed advanced nautical technologies that enabled them sea crossings and the navigation of watercraft guided by stars and also the sun. And then they also needed to know how to deal with tides and tempests on the open seas, for example.
Okay, so that's quite a departure. It's fascinating, it really is. That's quite a departure from the previous held beliefs about, you know, when that sort of activity first actually took off. So what led you to this conclusion? Why do you believe it is actually earlier?
We have the coastal settings of the megaliths, and we can follow their spread with radiocarbon dates over three phases. Then we have similar symbols and also a similar symbolic language which connects regions which are far distant. And then we have also evidence from the trade of greenstone from southern Spain to Brittany. And this must have been happening most probably along the seaways. And Brittany is also the only region where we have boats depicted on standing stones and in megalithic graves.
I wanted to ask you about this. So when we talk about megaliths, we're talking about those wonderful, great, big, huge standing stones. You mentioned what's depicted on them. I find this fascinating because I love these stones. Who doesn't? They're so evocative and so powerful. But you look at them and they really do look like just a brute stone face. How do you know that there are engravings on them? What tools, what techniques do you use to actually establish what the images are that's on them?
So I was documenting the megalithic art and engravings in Brittany using 3D modeling, but also using mostly laser scanning. And laser scanning is really a wonderful technique. And I used a handheld laser scanner to come into the narrow graves. And this was really working very well. And the results are analyzed with different software. And then we can make eroded symbols visible again, which are not to seen with the naked eye. And this is beautiful.
I think that's fascinating. Yeah, no.
It's a magic moment, really, when they're diving up.
You're looking at something that hasn't been seen for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It must be a real thrill.
Yeah, it is really, and it's really creating some kind of connection also to these societies, what is very nice.
Absolutely. So what were you seeing in the images? What images were you seeing that made you think that these people were seafaring?
As I said, Brittany is the only region where we have boats, and we found more and more boat engravings and boats with different materials and different types, but also other maritime symbols as sperm whales and giant squids. And especially the sperm whales, it was showing with the laser scanner that they were in connection to small boats, reminding very much the historical paintings from the 17th, 18th century of whaling. So this is very interesting.
Yeah. And I remember you mentioning in an earlier conversation we had that actually some of these images actually show the whales spouting.
Yes. And the whales are depicted, the depiction of us is depiction of living whales, this we can say, because we see the blow, we see the 3D dimension of the fluke, and everything is indicating that these societies really encountered living whales on the open sea.
Right. And so your hypothesis, maybe if I could put it that way, is that the people were drawn into maritime activity in pursuit of marine mammals because they make very good prey. Is that your idea?
Yeah, this was my idea from the beginning, and you have to develop advanced technology to follow whales. And this was maybe the beginning of the seafaring and of long distance maritime ventures.
Bettina, if you're right and people took to the waves earlier than initially thought, what would the impact on culture have been if there was more seafaring mobility in that era?
We have partly a common symbolic identity along the coasts of Atlantic Europe, and the sperm whales are repeating, but also symbols as crooks, and we find other symbols who are repeating. And then we have calais beads in the Breton tombs in Brittany, and calais is a shiny green mineral, which is very raw in Europe. And we can really trace that the raw material for the beads we find in Brittany are coming from southern Spain. And we don't find any beads there at this time. So they must have been trading the raw material. And it's one of the sources we have been identifying is accessible over the seaways and the rivers.
Bettina, how can you actually work out what these ancient communities were eating? What techniques are you using and what are you finding?
We are doing a huge range of natural scientific analyses. Beside ADNA, we are also doing isotopic analyses, and there especially the sulfur isotopes.
And what does that entail? What does that mean actually in practice?
We are measuring isotopes, sulfur, C13 and also N15 to reconstruct the diet. This is giving us indications for how much sea mammal fed or grain there was a really part of the diet. And we also taking environmental DNA, and they're researching also tracing for whale DNA, if you find it, with sediments from the graves. And in cooking pits, we're doing some organic residue analysis, and there we can isolate the lipids and look what these societies were cooking. Also, if they were cooking whale blubber or whales, or what kind of diet they had.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, please, Corinna.
I wanted to know something about evidence, archaeological evidence of actual boats, because you mentioned scenes entailing ships and whales engraved on rocks. But I was wondering whether there's any evidence of actual remains of boats.
No, there is not. Also not this kind of boats. There's much later, from the Bronze Age, from 1700 BCE. From the UK, we have a plank boat, for example. We have the dugout canoes. But the depictions in the graves and on the standing stones, they show different boat types. I think they mostly used skin boats, and you don't need to sail, you need to row. You need enough people to row, to get speed, to follow a weight, you need speed, you can't sail. To go back to the harbor then, to find the coast again, you need maybe a small sail, but to get speed, you need a lot of people who are rowers. And we have really depictions with 12 people on board, for example, from Brittany. So it would be enough.
That was fascinating and so risky and so physically demanding. Goodness me, the idea of having to keep up with them physically, you know, by just rowing. Gosh, yes, indeed. But you would need that precision, which you couldn't get with the sailing, of course, yes. Ah, interesting. Thank you very much. Well, that was absolutely fascinating. And I'm now going to turn to Corinna. Corinna, LIFE investigated late Roman settlements along frontier desert areas in the Western Sahara to get a clearer idea of the strategies used to control the empire's desert edges. You've built up a relationship, if I can put it that way, with the Umm al-Dabadib site. You've worked there for 25 years on and off. So can you tell us a little bit about the place? If we were looking at it, what would we see?
You would see, first of all, a very beautiful site. Said that when I went there for the first time over 25 years ago, I went there by chance. I was a PhD student at Cambridge at that time. And I thought, I saw it, and I said, what a wonderful place. When I go back to the library, I want to learn all about that. And when I actually went back, I realized that the site had never been, I'm not even saying studied, it had never been documented. So nothing existed about it. It was such a huge site, very well preserved, but nothing was known. There wasn't even a map. The site is located at the foot of an escarpment, which means that there's water coming from below and there is natural vegetation. So this must be something that was noted since the earliest times. So it is possible that there was a settlement well before the Roman times, but clearly in the early Roman time, we're talking about second, third century CE, we have a settlement, a Roman settlement there. But what happens at some point in the fourth century is that the Romans built a fortified settlement in front of the older settlement with this little fort in the middle and an enclosure wall all around. And that was quite a statement. The site, the area is hyper-arid, so it's very difficult to live there. But the Romans quarried 5 parallel aqueducts underground into the escarpment.
Tell us a little bit about the aqueducts and how they fed into a system of agriculture.
What they did was they quarried the gently sloping subterranean tunnels that went into the body of the escarpment and drew water and collected it by gravity on the surface to be cultivated. And then from there, there was a network of open air canal that spread for kilometers on the desert surface and turned this desert into a green garden.
Gosh.
And it's amazing because when you get there, you cannot see anything of the ancient fields, but for a few minutes at sunset, because the sun goes down and when there are no clouds, suddenly you see all the Roman centuriatio spreading on the fields, and then after a few minutes it's gone. And you can actually see it very well from the satellite, though.
Oh, that's fantastic. So it's the lowering of the sun with the shadows, casting long shadows across the surface of the earth. Ah, yes, I can imagine. Gosh, that must be a really amazing. It's like a little moment in the day where history just reveals itself and then boom, it's gone again. Oh gosh. Yeah. Thrilling, huh? What exactly was the extent? One question exactly, what was the extent? And the other question is, what were they growing? Do you have any idea?
The extent of the site is quite large. What survives at Umm al-Dabadib is a rare combination of what I call the two sides of the same coin. One that could not exist without the other, and one that was the reason for the other to exist, that is the settlement and the agricultural system, because the site had to be independent. So the settlement is quite small and concentrated, but the agricultural system spreads for kilometers. So it really takes up a lot of space and a lot of effort. We think we know what they grew. We could analyze the mud bricks of which the settlement is made, and they contain archaeobotanical remains. Of course, these remains date to the period in which the settlement was being built, so they don't tell anything about what happened later. But we made a study of the cultivations, and we realized that the fertility of the soil would sharply decline unless they adopted a crop rotation system. And even that wouldn't have been enough because only water would not be enough to sustain a long-term agricultural exploitation. So they had to add guano, for sure, pigeon guano. In fact, we found the remains of a pigeon tower, and clearly the pigeons were used to provide meat and also to provide guano for the cultivation.
Like a fertilizer.
Absolutely.
Oh, they're brilliant.
And this was crucial for the inhabitants to keep cultivating the land. And in fact, we think that the reason why the site was abandoned was actually the fact that the water table dropped. So it were the aqueducts stopped providing enough water to irrigate all the fields. And this was probably the reason why the site was eventually abandoned after only one century of occupation.
What would have the impact have been culturally? And I would say socioeconomically, of having an outpost of the Roman Empire there, would they have been collecting taxes from trade routes? What was the impact of the fort?
We realized that there is nothing that is non-Egyptian at the site. Allow me to explain. We realized, for instance, that the fortified settlement and the fort were constructed using the ancient Egyptian unit of measurement. And the dead were buried after Egyptian customs and religious cults. So there's nothing that really tells us of a foreign presence there. So clearly this is a group of Egyptians that were being resettled there by the Roman authorities, of course. There must have been Roman soldiers or soldiers belonging to the Roman army, but they're likely to have been Egyptian themselves. And if you look at the fort and you look at it from the distance, you would think that it was full of armed soldiers guarding some sort of treasure inside. But actually out there, the real treasure were water and food. Water was available from the aqueducts, and the food, so laboriously cultivated and collected, was actually stored in the fort. So the fort was actually food storage, guarded probably by a small contingent of soldiers. And the role of the site was to guard one of the water sources along the caravan routes that led to the core of the oasis. And there were other similar sites all around the Kharga oasis. And then nearby, there is a huge alum mine. So most probably this site was built there also to coordinate the exploitation of this alum mine. And alum was being traded to the valley and then to the core of the Roman Empire. Alum was a very important mineral used to as a disinfectant, to dye textiles, and to as additives to medicaments of various types. So it was an important commodity, and the Kharga mines must have been quite important in antiquity.
Okay, thank you. And thank you particularly for explaining what alum was without me having to come in and ask you. I'm very grateful you did that. I think I'm going to have to reveal my ignorance here. Thank you. Very good. That's fascinating. Do we have any questions at all for Corinna? Sophia, I think you had a question.
Yes, Corinna. Probably this question during the Roman time wouldn't be politically correct. But today, I think that I can ask you about your perspective. Is this the whole, this process of Romanization was beneficial for the people in Egypt, especially when it comes to the food production and supply?
It's difficult to answer in a precise way because, as I said, we found evidence only of Egyptian activities. So clearly, yes, in a way, because people who lived there were provided with enough resources to build a substantial settlement. The houses are quite large and luxurious houses. They're very nice. They're not barracks in the middle of nowhere. So people were accommodated in a very nice and comfortable way. So yes, clearly, I've had the impression that if I can use these terms, make a very clear distinction. I think these were some sort of colonies. We're not talking about colonialism. We're talking about colonization.
Thank you very much. Excellent. Lovely. Sophia, I'm going to turn to you now. Your project was the Birth Project, and that looked into the key biological and cultural mechanisms affecting fertility rates and infancy during the early Middle Holocene, which is 10,000 to 5,000 BCE in the Balkans. May I ask you, Sophia, why did you feel that it was important to study the lives of prehistoric mothers and babies?
I think that motherhood topic is very important as survival of humans depending on the quality of life of prehistoric mothers and babies, but how they lived is almost unknown. So based on the small density of archaeological remains during the first 2.5 million years of human evolution, it was assumed that that until 10,000 years ago, so until the Neolithic, the number of people on Earth was very small. So before the Neolithic, mothers probably gave birth to only one child. So in order to find out, did Neolithic mothers really started to have more babies? So we investigated the biological evidence of the number of pregnancies and also how long babies were breastfed, what was supplementary food, as well as how Neolithic culture contributed to changes in motherhood.
And what was known about that before you started your project?
Actually, we didn't have any biological evidences about the number of pregnancies. So everything about the human demography was based on archaeological remains. So the main idea is to find the first biological evidences about the number of pregnancies, but also about all those other aspects which are relevant for the understanding of this important process of the fertility increase. So, for example, to investigate the number of pregnancies, we decided to count the number of so-called crisis lines, so hidden in the root of our teeth. So this is the tooth cementum annulation method, which is based on two facts. First, each of us gets a new layer of tooth cementum every year. So when the root of tooth is cut with a diamond saw and the thin section is made and looks under the microscope, according to the number of lines of tooth cementum, so as same as with the rings on tree, we can say how old is a person. Secondly, and more important, previous clinical study of our colleagues in Germany on a woman with a known number of pregnancies showed that during the year of pregnancy, probably due to the calcium problems, this line is different. So it's shape changes and it's become deeper and irregular. So that allows us to investigate whether and to what extent the number of those so-called crisis lines and number of pregnancies increase and in the Neolithic woman. And second, when it comes to another important aspects of fertility, this is the duration of breastfeeding. So we decided to investigate the differences of the duration of breastfeeding in Neolithic and in previous periods.
That's great. And I'd like to discuss the breastfeeding and the whole notion of the infancy and the weaning in a second. But I'd like to go back now to these rings in the teeth just a second to understand better. So they're almost like, you could say, crisis rings. We could say maybe stress rings. So what we're talking about here is the impact of pregnancy on the body's ability to lay down calcium in the teeth. Because I believe we were also thinking in an earlier conversation that there was in fact a difference between the number of stress rings in male teeth more in the period before when we were more hunter-gatherer. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's true. Our results, because we didn't analyze only females, we also have, let's say, control group of males, because those crisis lines also can appear when we broke the bone and we have a problem with calcium, or we have some kidney disease. So we cannot be sure that each line is only connected to the pregnancy. But in our control groups, it shows that males before the Neolithic have more crisis lines. But in Neolithic, the life, it's looked like that Neolithic brought some more peaceful life for males, because we couldn't find so many crisis lines in male during the Neolithic. In the contrary to the female, when this number of crises line exploded during the Neolithic.
Right. And so that's another reason why you actually posit that that might be relating, in fact, to the number of yeah. pregnancies and births. And so the population exploded and we're seeing more stress rings in females, perhaps indicating number of pregnancies. And what was the cause? What do we imagine was the reason for this sudden increase in the number of pregnancies?
What we found in our sample, in our microregion, and what is also suggested by some other scientists, that is also possible very important aspects of this increase, are those changes in a way of life. So basically, Neolithic people introduced the milk of domesticated animals and plants. But what was very important to us to investigate is that all those innovations had influence to the duration of the breastfeeding, because the breastfeeding is directly connected to fertility. So as longer we are breastfed, it will be harder to come to possibility for the new pregnancy. And we analyzed the duration of breastfeeding of mothers, or actually of children who lived 10,000 years ago, and until 5,000 years ago. And what we had found through the isotopic study is that children in Neolithic were breastfed for 1 year, even less, and that mothers before the Neolithic breastfed their children until age of 4, sometimes even 5 years of age.
And what enabled this transition? Why was the breastfeeding period shorter in the Neolithic?
We think that this is invention of new supplementary food. So the domestication of plant and animals allow to make new type of porridge. So new type of baby food appear. And this new type of baby food was available all year around. So it was not dependent on hunting and gathering or conditions. So it was easy to have one stone and to use cereals and milk to make, you know, like today's mother also do the same with the supplementary food. So we think that this new type of porridge was actually something which allow mother to breastfeed shorter, but also for other members of community to participate more in the whole feeding process, because with this new type of porridge, it was possible for fathers, grandmothers, younger children to feed the babies.
And what is causing you to think about the idea of porridge or alternative food? Yes, the food was existing, but have you found any artifacts that would pose the idea that there would be porridge?
Yeah. We actually found through this isotopic study, so in the chemical composition of bones, that weaning food had changed with the Neolithic, so with more carbohydrates from the new plants. But what was very exciting for us, because when we discovered that females started to breastfeed for such short period of time, we was thinking, what we can find in archaeological record which indicate this very important change which happened. And we found that in Neolithic, completely new type of tool appear. Those are small bone tools made from the metapodial bones of the cow. And thousands of those small bone spoons appear. And we discovered the teeth marks on thousands of teeth marks on those spoons. So we realized that Neolithic people not only invented new type of food, but also they produce very specific type of tool to feed the baby. So this was very exciting for us, because it shows that something really new and innovative happened, and it was followed but also the, you know, new type of weaning equipment.
Well, I like the idea of weaning equipment in the Neolithic. Isn't that great? Neolithic weaning equipment, little tiny bone spoons with teeth marks on. Isn't that cool? Thank you so much, Sophia. It's fascinating. And of course, this then causes a population explosion. And we were quite precarious before, weren't we? The population was considered to be quite small and we were fragile and vulnerable. And then suddenly, boom, it takes off and you're feeding babies with spoons. Fantastic. Okay, does anyone have any questions for Sophia? Bettina, yes, please.
This is really interesting. And we noticed that in the Neolithic, the demographic is exploding. And you really think because of this, they could have more babies, more children. And the porridge is the reason why there were so many Neolithic people, finally.
I think it's one of the most important because it's allowed the shorter breastfeeding. Before that, it really was not easy to find some supplementary food. So as a hunter-gatherer, you can provide the fish or you are very limited, you know, and you are dependent on a weather condition or on a climatic condition. So this was very important innovation. Like in the 19th century, when new supplementary food was invented, the population growth happened. So because it's really directly connected to the fertility circle. So if you do not breastfeed until age of 3 or 4 years, like in Mesolithic, I think that was one of the most important, I don't say the only one reason, but very important reason for the fertility increase.
And also, as you say, it enables communal caring for the babies. It's not just the mother that has to be then out of, we could almost say, a role of productivity for, you know, sourcing other food and so on. I mean, she's not tied to a small infant.
Yeah, definitely this contributed to the important change in the whole system of this cooperative breeding. So we are cooperative breeders, so we are helping each other to raise the children. But with this new supplementary food, it was possible to upgrade this system on and put it on a completely new level.
Fascinating. Wonderful. Yes, please, Corinna.
And I suppose that also the fact that people became stably located in one place, so they were not nomads anymore, and they just stopped in the same place and established stable settlements, and that also helped raising more babies, I think, because having one single place where food was stably kept and conserved and provided also helped. It was part of the big picture, I suppose.
Definitely, definitely. We also think that houses were very important, especially because houses were heated. So that have also important influence on the process of the thermoregulation, because if you have thermally stable conditions, like from the Neolithic, this is also important for the birth process and for the survival of the babies after the birth. So absolutely the house life was very, very important for the success of humans.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, all three of you. I think that's absolutely fascinating. See how that how these various communities and cultures spun off in different directions once a new source of food was revealed and available. Thank you. I think that was just wonderful. Very much enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're all very welcome. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode, check out the podcast homepage on the Cordis website and listen to other episodes wherever it is that you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to make sure that the hottest research in EU-funded science isn't passing you by. And if you enjoy listening, why not spread the word and tell your friends? We've talked about the latest forensic tools developed to help identify perpetrators, how elephant tusks are inspiring robotics, and whether it will ever be possible to forecast when a volcano is about to erupt. In our last 33 episodes, there'll be something there to tweak your curiosity. Perhaps you want to know what other EU-funded projects are doing in this domain. The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by Horizon 2020 and Horizon Europe that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects, from macrophages to macroeconomics. There's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your area. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.